concerned with a great deal of the background for the whole process of getting ourselves here in the fourth round. And I want to take up now, really quite specifically, insofar as we can, Shloka 5, which deals with this effort of earth, which we've been talking about, but let's see if we can put it together. This effort of the earth, not the earth as we know it, please remember that, but in its very ethereal pre-formative stage, to produce some forms, to finally get a sentient evolution in the sense of a conscious evolution going. And the efforts are extremely interesting. I realize that one of the very fascinating sidelines in all of this to pursue, and indeed one could devote, and who knows, I might do this one of these days, one could devote an entire series at this stage in our studies in the secret doctrine to the various creation myths as they concern humanity. I don't know if you're referring at all to the references that I give you in the secret doctrine, but you realize that, if you are, that it is at this stage that HPB herself introduces so many of these creation myths. How did she know them all? How is she familiar with all of them? When you consider the very small library which she had, certainly the very few books that she had with her in Würzburg in Germany when she was writing some of this, in Ostend in Belgium, and then finally in England, and you can see that library that she had with her, that she had about her at the time of her death in 1891 in London. You can see that library if you visit the English section headquarters. It is there. And when I compare it to my own extensive library and always purchasing books, as Zella well knows, I'm one of her best customers, I think, have been at Wheaton and now here. And I think, my heavens, I don't even know what's in some of them. I mean, I can't always remember. And how HPB had this extensive knowledge of the various mythologies. She even does refer, of course, to the Mayan Kishru. She has references to that. And to the Babylonian, the Chaldean, of course, many, many myths in the Puranic stories of India, a marvelous subject one could go into just in studying the Puranas and the esoteric significance of all of that. And she introduces bits and pieces here in this very early stage, and points out, of course, that myth after myth refers to creative developments that failed, that really did not come about, that had to be destroyed. And it gives, in one sense, a new meaning to the opening chapter of the Judeo-Christian Bible of Genesis. HPB herself points out that this indeed must have been following some failures, some efforts. Now we may say, are there any failures? Well, let's not get into that just at the moment. We can eventually, but the very fact that after each of these so-called days in bringing about a new beginning that correspond with the return to this globe D. It is said that the Elohim say it is good, as though, well, finally we made it, sort of thing. Okay, that is good. They have reached a development that they could approve of, and gets the whole cycle going again. Well, that's just by the way, as it were, because I'd like to really look now more closely at Shloka 5. It had been my aim in this series, and next week is our last one for this particular series, you know, to complete through Shloka 10. Now, whether we can do that, I'm not sure, but that's all right. I think it's perhaps more interesting to go into these sidelines, I hope you agree, and to look at it in some depth rather than just skim the surface. Even at that, we are skimming the surface, I must say, mainly because I'm continually discovering new things myself, and I hope you are, new insights that make it more meaningful. Well, the description that is given to us in Shloka 5, and we've already talked a bit about the crores and so on, refers to a period when the human kingdom had not yet returned to this globe, or had begun its evolutionary cycle on globe D, the lowest wheel of our present planetary chain. At this stage, we have, as the shloka so graphically describes, soft stones that hardened, referring to the mineral kingdom, whose very evolution is that of the planet itself. Consequently, that element of life, that life wave, which were soft stones in preceding rounds, are now hardened, or are on their way to being hardened, we might be more appropriate, and hard plants that softened. Two very graphic descriptions that are given to us, soft stones that hardened and hard plants that softened, because now the life wave, as it moves into the vegetable kingdom, is achieving a greater mobility, which means a softening effect that must come about. In an earlier passage, in volume 1, page 254, HPB speaks indeed of the first manifestation of plants, and she quotes from the second chapter of Genesis, "The Lord God made the earth and the heavens, and every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. For the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth." The water principle had not yet appeared. HPB then adds there, "An absurdity unless the esoteric explanation is accepted. The plants were created before they were in the earth, for there was no earth then such as it is now. And the herb of the field was in existence before it grew, as it does now in the fourth round." So the whole vegetable kingdom existed, but not as it is now, of course. And she also provides an explanation of how the forms of minerals, plants, and animals came into manifestation in this round. It's a very interesting explanation. This occurs in volume 2 as a footnote on page 68. It's a process that I think must be analogous to, indeed, from statements in the Mahatma letters, one can say it is indeed a process analogous to the way in which the early letters of the Mahatmas were precipitated. What Master Cage once called sweet and easy precipitation, I think, wasn't that the term, sweet and easy? So There is an analogous process taking place. She says, the astral prototypes of the mineral, vegetable, and animal kingdoms up to man have taken that time, 300 million years, they've taken that time to evolve, reforming out of the cast-off materials of the preceding round, that is, the third round, which, though very dense and physical in their own cycle, are relatively ethereal as compared with the materiality of our present middle round. And then she says, at the expiration of those 300 million years, nature, on the way to the physical and material, down the arc of descent, begins with mankind and works downwards, hardening or materializing forms as it proceeds. Thus, the fossils found in strata, and this is the interesting point she makes, the fossils found in strata, to which an antiquity not of 18 but of many hundreds of millions of years, and this, of course, is being shown today as more accurate methods of dating have developed even in the 100 years since H.P.B. wrote The Secret Doctrine. Many of the fossils are being recognized as of much older origin than was thought to be true 100 years ago. So these fossils, she says, must be ascribed that period to which an antiquity must be ascribed, belong in reality to forms of the preceding round, which, while living, were far more ethereal than physical as we know the physical. Now, how did they get to be physical? You see, that we perceive and disinter them as tangible forms is due to the process of materialization or crystallization referred to, which took place subsequently at the beginning of the fourth round. So that as the minerals hardened, soft stones that hardened, so this imprint, as it were, from the astral ethereal also hardened, and we see then what was in the last round simply ethereal forms. As I say, it seems to me from what the masters wrote about the process of precipitation, this is analogous to that, that it moves from that inner level, the astro-etheric level, into physical form. And in one place, they can't remember the term they used, George or Virginia may remember it, of this process. It's a complicated term. But, you remember it, George?
Something like litho-biblio.
Yes, litho-biblio something, isn't it? Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's in one of the letters. And would seem to be, would you agree with me that this seems to be analogous to?
Interesting thought.
Yeah, at least. So she says that we perceive and disinter them as tangible forms is due to the process of materialization or crystallization, which took place subsequently at the beginning of the fourth round and reached its maximum after the appearance of man, proceeding parallel with his physical evolution. So that as our physical evolution proceeds, as we get into, you know, denser and denser vehicles, so the entire planet and everything in it, including these fossils, as it were, become more perceptible at our level. So, as she continues, this alone illustrates the fact that the degree of materiality of the Earth changes pari passu with that of its inhabitants. And thus man now finds as tangible fossils what were once, to his present senses, ethereal forms of the lower kingdoms. Very interesting. I think it's quite an amazing statement and deserves our consideration. Well, she further elaborates the entire subject of the evolutionary development of mineral and plant forms, a development, of course, that was the result of a previous cycle, since they were produced in the third round. And this is in volume 2, page 186. These stones, plants, and animals were the prototypes, the filmy presentments of those of the fourth round. And even those at the beginning of the fourth round were the astral shadows of the present, as the occultists express it. And finally, the forms and genera of neither man, animal, nor plant were what they became later. Thus, the astral prototypes of the lower beings of the animal kingdom of the fourth round, which preceded the chayas of men, the shadows of men. Incidentally, when we say the astral prototypes, remember that the word astral, as HPB was using it, was the etheric, as we now use it, not the astral of Bessant Leadbeater and the later writings, when there was a greater clarification of terminology. So these are, while she calls them the astral prototypes, these are the etheric, what we would call the etheric prototypes. Of these, of the lower beings of the animal kingdom of the fourth round, which preceded the chayas of men, that is, the shadows of men, were the consolidated, though still very ethereal sheaths of the still more ethereal forms or models produced at the close of the third round on Globe D. And then she quotes from the later shloka, produced from the residue of the substance matter, from dead bodies of men and other extinct animals of the wheel before, or the previous third round, as shloka 28 tells us. Well, that there's an entire passage on which begins on page 185 of volume 2 that would be pertinent here, but since we're going to come to it later when we do get to shlokas 28 to 32, we'll leave it and take it up there in its appropriate place. But you might just like to refer to it sometime this summer when you have nothing else to do and you pick up the secret doctrine to look into it. You know, it's an interesting study. But the point is that at the beginning of this round, these forms, gradually coming more and more into materialization, you see, were produced from the residue of the substance matter, because there was nothing else to use. From dead bodies of men and other extinct animals of the wheel before. Well, our concern, as I've said, is with this present fourth round, and we've continued to emphasize it. And in that connection, we should recognize then that shlokas 5 and 6 really refer to a stage just prior to, or just at the beginning of, just prior to the coming of the human life wave to Globe D, our Earth, in this fourth round. Barborka refers to this preliminary period as a period of dormancy. I'm sorry he's not still living. I'd like to discuss it. Well, there are many things I wanted to discuss with Jeffrey, but he died before I had a chance to discuss them. We did discuss a number of things, but there are always more things you wish you could sit down and discuss with people. I really feel that that's not a completely accurate term. Certainly, we need to be careful to realize that what is dormant is not the globe itself, because the globe is now awakening. The globe is now trying to produce forms. And you, of course, maybe you could say, well, these were sort of nightmarish, yes, and so she, sort of, the globe sort of produced them in her sleep. But the globe is awakening and making this effort. What is really dormant, of course, is the fact that the human life wave has not yet reached it. The struggle, of course, as I say, is rather pathetic to produce human beings. The earth, it's alive. It has its own degree of sentiency, and perhaps even of a rudimentary form of consciousness. But it's unable, of course, to produce on its own self-conscious entities, human beings. And I was thinking in this connection of the efforts of science today to explain the birth of the mind as simply the resultant of the formation of the brain. You know, and this is, of course, where a great deal of research is concentrated today. This is the latest field. This is the thing to get into today, is brain-mind research, the whole neuro field, the field of the development of the neurons of the brain and so on. That the slow evolutionary process in the development of the human form, from what is called the hominid, should suddenly leap forward and produce a thinking, self-reflective, fully human being. To me, and I expect to all theosophical students, and certainly even to all serious thinkers, it's an utter absurdity. And here in Shlokas 5 and 6, we see the very same absurdity in terms of planetary growth. The earth attempts to create from her own bosom, as Shloka 5 states. And what comes forth? Watermen, terrible and bad. And as Shloka 8 describes these creatures, creations, forms which were two-faced and four-faced, goat men, dog-headed men, men with fish's bodies. It's an amazing spectacle. And I... You know, no wonder that in the Puranas, creation is described as a lila, the sport of the gods, because I think the gods must have looked on and roared with laughter over what was being produced. I think they must have had a jolly good time, you know, looking on and saying, look what's being brought forth. Isn't that marvelous? What new creature? He must have had a glorious time. Well, this theme, as I've just said earlier, of the attempt to produce conscious beings, this theme is found in many, many myths. And HPB refers to the Chaldean account of creation, the Hindu Puranas, and many other cosmogonical accounts. Ashish, in Man, Son of Man, cites the Babylonian creation myth. And, of course, refers also to one of the most wonderful of the Hindu myths, the myth of the goddess Parvati, who, it is said, was solely responsible for the creation of insects, by means of which she hoped to secure the attention of Shiva by disturbing him in his meditation. I think it's an absolutely delightful myth. It's one of my favorites, you know. I mean, after all, if she wanted to get the attention of the god who's seated in profound contemplation, profound meditation, you know, I think she thought up the best device and could come up with. She created insects to, you know, prick him and crawl around on him and et cetera, et cetera. And she gained his attention, of course. And, of course, he married her. I mean, what else could the god do? because Parvati becomes one of the wives of Shiva. Well, generally, in these myths, and this, I think, is an important point, I hate to say it from one point of view, but it's an important point, it is the female goddess who comes up with rather repulsive creatures. Indicating, of course, that, of course, the earth as Gaia is the receptive, the feminine aspect. I guess men are necessary. But it's a rather interesting point, you see, that the feminine by itself, and this, of course, in any study of the feminine, one can look at that marvelous work of Erich Neumann, the great Jungian, called The Great Mother. It's a tremendous volume. One can see in that this whole side of the feminine aspect, which becomes the terrible mother, the obsessive mother, the mother that wants to swallow and consume her progeny. But Arshish stresses the significance of this attempt, this effort at creation. In Man, Son of Man, page 52, the point in ascribing these productive powers to the material universe is that not until the divine consciousness looks out on its own creation through the mind of man does the duality between consciousness and its content become fully explicit. And this duality, because there is this sense of absorption, there must be a clear-cut definition, defined duality, which enables then perception to come about. And I would suggest that if you're not familiar with it, Ashish's entire chapter on parthenogenesis merits a great deal of study and consideration. He deals with the whole nature of mythological thinking, which is really being expressed in these early shlokas. He suggests, for example, that in such a context, the production of watermen, terrible and bad, can be understood as something like pre-human hominids. And we see science attempting to conjecture about this early stage. But the interesting point to note is that the production is not only termed terrible, which can have the meaning of awesome, can have the meaning of frightening. It's also bad, which implies a moral judgment. Actually, as is evident from the early nature of this stage in the development of the globe, these productions were, as Ashish puts it, even theoretically incapable of being anything but what they were. They certainly were. How could they be anything but what they were? And hence valuations of good and bad should really not be ascribed to them. So why are they called not only terrible but bad? Since such evaluation is given to them, it calls our attention to really a profound psychological truth. These watermen, terrible and bad, are then not only part of our own ancestral heritage, they may even still be present within us today. That is, they take their life, as Ashish suggests, from the dross and slime of our unregenerate desires. So Ashish reminds us of a passage which we find in Light on the Path, a wonderful little work. He that chooses evil refuses to look within himself, shuts his ears to the melody of his heart, as he blinds his eyes to the light of his soul. He does this because he finds it easier to live in desires. But underneath all life is the strong current that cannot be checked. The great upper waters are there in reality. Find them, and you will perceive that none, not the most wretched of creatures, but is a part of it. however he blind himself to the fact and build up for himself a phantasmal form of horror. Very interesting passage in Light on the Path, which takes on a kind of new meaning. So we can rightly note that it's not the earth so much who refuses to call the sons of heaven to her aid, but often we ourselves refuse to call on anything higher, what are called in the Light on the Path, the upper waters. And only the fiery powers of our higher selves, the law of the high, as they're called in the shlokas, can clear our turbid desires of their hydra-headed sensuality. But remember, of course, that the earth is aware that there is a higher power. The earth appealed to the Lord of the Shining Face. So even as she produced these creatures, she is aware of the other side of her nature. Again, after all, again to quote Ashish, the material universe is itself the result of the union of sparks of the parent flame with the waters of life. So we cannot ascribe any production, any manifestation to one pole only of the primal duality which defines manifestation. So even though it appears that she brings them forth of herself, nothing can come forth out of one pole only. In a manifested universe, there is resident within earth at least the principle that will recognize the other pole of the original duality, the spirit side of matter. And certainly that we can refer to our own being, that even as we may bring forth at times rather repulsive forms out of our own unregenerate desires, if we want to put it that way, we realize that there is something within us that could produce something better, that we have this possibility. And so Shloka 6, of course, continues the story of this early effort at the production of man. The watermen, terrible and bad, she herself created from the remains of others, from the mineral, vegetable, and animal remains. From the first, second, and third rounds, she formed them. That's the beginning of Shloka 6, you remember. And that's enough at the moment to look at, because I would suggest that really the second part of Shloka 6 and Shloka 7 really sort of go after you've read part of Shloka 8. I think things have gotten mixed up at this stage. Now, as we've already pointed out, it's not only watermen that have been created, but what she describes in Shloka 8, and so you've got to put them all together, not only watermen, terrible and bad, but two- and four-faced goat men, dog-headed men, and men with fish's bodies. Why not get them all together? It's quite an assortment, but all the production, all of it, remember, uses matter which remained or was cast off from the earlier rounds, from earlier evolutionary stages. And we must note, therefore, that just as for the earth in this early period, she had only, at this stage, only that which remained, the sishtas, the seeds, the cast-off material from the earlier, so in one sense, the residue of this is all within us, out of all of our previous incarnations. And at times we simply reshape these remains from previous incarnations, because it's all part of our ancestral heritage. It's all within us. The residue of our own psychic stages, equivalent to the mineral, vegetable, and animal existences not through which we've been, but equivalent to that for earth, the very same stages are within us, and we continually reform this. As Ashish puts it, the world is a picture book of symbols, each page of which tells us some inner truth about ourselves. And our lives are myths whose every event is expressive of the cosmic harmony. Well, even apart, of course, from the psychological and symbolic meaning, there's the inescapable fact, which is pointed to in Shlokas 5, the early part of 6, and part of Shloka 8, that as H.P.B. states in her commentary, thus physical nature, and I think we have to see when we use the term physical nature, that it includes what we might well call the other principles, the etheric, the pranic, the comic, or desire nature, and perhaps even to some extent the lower manasic, the very sort of faint stirrings of the lower manasic. So it's not just physical per se, but it must include, certainly it must include the etheric, because it's the sensate nature. And I suggest it also includes, well, it would have to include the pranic, you see, and also to some extent, definitely I feel the comic nature, and perhaps to some extent the lower manasic. H.P.B. says, thus, physical nature, when left to herself in the creation of animal and man, is shown to have failed. She can produce the first two and the lower animal kingdoms. And that's why I say, to some extent, the very glimmerings of lower manas, because the lower animal kingdom, there is still some perhaps just touch at the lower manasic level. But when it comes to the turn of man, spiritual, independent, and intelligent powers are required for his creation besides the coats of skin and the breath of animal life. The human monads of preceding rounds need something higher than purely physical materials to build their personalities with, under the penalty of remaining even below any Frankenstein animal. It's page 56 of volume 2. So nature has tried her best. She's labored, brought forth watermen, goatmen, and so on. She was able to reassemble forms only from the materials available, the residue of the past, from previous rounds, you see. This, I think, again, has a very real analogy with the fact that each incarnation is, to some extent, the recreation, the reformation of all the physical cycle, physical psychic residue of past incarnations. But happily, there is always that something more. This, of course, is what ultimately brings man into manifestation in the fourth round. If we had to deal only with a reassembly of everything we have been in the past, it would be pretty bad, wouldn't it? And pretty tiresome after a while. There would be no further advance. One could reassemble and reassemble and reassemble. So we have to recognize that the forms of nature, of course, that the forms which the earth produced in this way were not really, of course, composed of the kind of physicality that we know today. Remember that. We're not talking about the same kind of physicality that we know. Ashish describes it so graphically. I like the way he puts many of these things. So, as I say, this whole chapter on parthenogenesis which is a whole concept, of course, of the virgin origin, which is what parthenogenesis means, of course, of beings, you see. As he puts it, these are not physical bodies, they are scarcely bodies at all, but rather eddies or disturbances left behind in the desire-impregnated atmosphere of being. This is the dross and slime, the residual desire of her first, second, and third, the desire components of the old three races. In a sense, this too recapitulates at a lower level the whole process of bringing into existence the entire, well, it recapitulates the entire cosmogonic process. HPB refers, for example, again, to the great allegory in the Puranas, I think in the Vishnu Purana, actually. Yes, in the Vishnu Purana, that Brahma, the creative principle, Brahma, who is collectively, she says, the creative force of the universe, is said to be at the beginnings of the yugas, or the beginnings of the cycle, possessed of the desire and of the power to create, and impelled by the potencies of what is to be created. It's a marvelous statement. Possessed of the desire and the power to create. Now, the desire is out of the past, and this is why the entire system, as viewed by the theosophical philosophy, the esoteric philosophy, is one of unimaginable beginnings and unimaginable endings, you see, because that is the very push into manifestation, but also impelled by the potencies of what is to be created. And so perhaps this repeated by analogy in our whole cycle of incarnations, by the desire which is welled up through numerous incarnations and which now has thrust us out again, but also the potencies, that is, the potentialities of that which ultimately we can become. Perhaps we are as much pulled by the future as driven by the past. If you want to, karma and dharma. But I'm feel very sure of this, that we are as much pulled by the future, that there is a kind of magnetic pull that is present, as well as the gravitational pull that gets us back into this reassemblage. Now, therefore, we don't have to imagine that we're free of the cast-off remnants of our own past. They are there, and they have to be dealt with. And this, of course, is what contemporary psychology is addressing very much. We have to deal with it. Ashish again puts it so very clearly, so why don't I quote him? Even now we live surrounded by an atmosphere or sea that constantly receives the impressions of our individual moods and lusts, and from which we are forced to receive in turn the cast-off desire patterns of others. This is no fanciful imagery. The subtle atmosphere attaching to people and through people to places and objects is an experiential reality. In itself, this sea, S-E-A, is nothing terrible and bad, but it is the vehicle of all the desires that have ever been. It's a rather awesome suggestion, isn't it? A rather awesome sort of thing. But we live in this, you see. And so our work, you see, as we will come to later, and I'm spending a lot of time on this, but I think it's important because it points up the very real responsibility and the task that we have, the uniqueness, because, of course, there were those who came, the Dhyanis who came and first looked on and said, my gosh, we're not going to get involved in those horrible creatures. Displeased they were, as the stanza, as the shloka says. Naturally, they'd be displeased. You wonder sometimes if the monad, looking on at a new incarnation of the ego, may feel a little displeased that it has only this to. Good grief, you know, look at that reassemblage of desire components, and what am I going to do with that? But I think we have to realize that we live in this sea, so what we ourselves send out contributes to this whole atmosphere. The impressions, you know, and because we receive and return the cast-off desire patterns of others. And when he uses desire patterns in the sense of all that goes on in the whole realm of karma. And as that is purified by the light of Buddha, then, of course, we surround ourselves and push out into the world, as it were, that white light. That, in one sense, these earlier creations are still all within us. It's very true that in a later shloka in this particular series, in fact, in shloka 8, they slew, that is, these flames who came, the laws of the high and the lama yin of the below, which we'll come to later, but they slew these forms. So one can say, well, are the forms then, how can they still be within us? Now, we, as I say, we have to recall that at this very early period, at the beginning of the fourth round, the fourth time, on the globe D, the globe is not of the same physicality that it is today. That it is in a very ethereal, and so the forms were themselves ethereal. I've always responded to this term or this phrase, integrations of desire forces, because in many ways I think even physically we are simply integrations, are eddies or whirlpools, however you want, disturbances. We're of course, from the point of view of physics, I suppose we could say we're interferences with light rays. And this is very true from contemporary physics. We constitute an interference pattern. And if you want to read about this more fully, I think one of the best explanations was given by Itzhak Bentov in his book Stalking the Wild Pendulum, which is a marvelously easy explanation of this whole thing of interference patterns. And in one sense, that's all you are, is an interference pattern of light. Now, from this point of view, we, even in the physical vehicle, can say we're crystallized light, but light so crystallized that it is opaque, therefore. And so at the subtler levels, these are integrations which at one level of consciousness has to be really worked out. But all of the strands of our past, all of our ancestral history, is contained within us. And the process then is of now what I don't know how to express it. To me, it's a kind of purificatory process, a bringing about, Stefan Heller is putting it in alchemical terms, of a process which in the yogic literature is called tapas, a burning away a heating which sort of boils off the, making jam and you skim off the scum, as it boils up and so on. And it's a purificatory sort of process.
This morning we were saying that we are going towards more density. Now, how far more dense can we get?
Well, I'm only saying what the doctrine suggests. I think in one sense we're on the way up. I mean, this we are told, this round, the fourth round, globe D, you see, we're sort of at the bottom of the pile, you see, in that sense, globe D. And so we have A, B, and C, you see, and E, F, and G are at subtler levels, you see. And so here we are on our own, and we're told that having come here, that we're in the fourth round, that this is as low as we're ever going to get, you see. This is really the bottom. There's no place to go but up from this point of view. And we're in the fifth stage, developmental stage, in terms of consciousness. So we're a little bit past then the absolute bottom point, you see, from that point of view.
Now this morning you were talking about the third stage, so that would be most of the time you were. That would be before the
before
stage we're in now when
that's
we
right.
were in the ethereal.
This is coming in then, you
right.
see. So it's the pre... You can call it the pre-fourth in one sense. And of the rounds, you see, we've been around this cycle before. It's true, we've been here before. Now, you in your present consciousness may not remember it, because the brain, as it now exists in a physical body, has not had that same kind of density before. But we've been, so now we're at the end of the third time around. What we're talking about is the pre-fourth, and a new attempt is made.
But the accumulation would be in our subconscious.
But the accumulation is there in our subconscious or unconscious, and this, it is said, you see, this is what contemporary psychology is saying, that the totality of that is present in some manner.
In the book, The Deepening of the Earth, Jeffrey Bob Walker has globe D on the fifth
That's right.
subplane.
Mm-hmm.
What then can be lower? Presumably
the sixth and seventh, isn't it? Yes.
What is it, something denser in the physical sense?
It would appear so, but I can't really feel that it's the same physicality in as we know it, because again we've been told that this is the turning point, so that the fifth round, although on a lower subplane, would not necessarily be of the same dense physicality. This is something we haven't been told. We can only conjecture. Yes. But I think to me the important thing is, you know, where we are. And of course, well, George and I were talking during the break about this whole matter of time, you see. The more we study time, of course, the less we know about it. Let's be frank about that. This is very true. But I think we have to be very careful about this matter of assigning time periods and what will happen when. In a sense, it may all be present. In another sense, it may all be present. And it is our consciousness that is sort of becoming aware of that, of those instants of the present, which may turn the whole thing on its head, in a sense. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is very true, it seems to me, that these integrations, and they are integrations, that is, whatever we have experienced in any incarnation is integrated into all the experiences of the past and is present then at every moment and can be set off. I was saying to Matty, you see, often we think of it in terms of the negatives of the desire forces. I mean, I do get angry, yes. Now there's this anger. Is this out of the past experience of what constitutes anger? And I've got to deal with it. I've got to deal with it, not by thrusting it down and saying, oh no, I'm above that, and it was my emotional body sort of thing that got angry, but I am superior to that, and so on. Or do I recognize that I have to face this in some way, deal with it, and bring it to another level? Which is, you see, this matter of slaying. They slew these forms, you see. And we get this word in many of the other things, you see, kill out desire and kill out this and kill out that. I'm just by nature, I guess, opposed to any violence, and I don't like killing anything. I mean, one might want it someday, so why kill it? In any event, I don't think one transforms energy. I'm very much a medieval alchemist in that. One does not kill it, one transforms it, because energy cannot be destroyed. Cannot be destroyed. So one transforms it, one utilizes it, and the same energy that I expend on being angry over something is still available to me, but now available if I withdraw it from that which has appeared to make me angry, and I use the energy then at another level. So there is another integration. I don't know that I'm making much sense to you, but anyway. John?
We distinguish between the form and the energy.
Yes, I think this is true.
If somebody else's desire we didn't care for, or the form, or we didn't like the form, we just take the energy maybe and use it.
I suppose, but I think we have to realize that forms are the resultant of energy integrations, if you want to call them that. It's a very complex problem, yes. Virginia?
Could it be in this matter of the sixth and seventh of subplanes mentioned of our world, that there are even now denser levels that we're not conscious of?
Oh, yes, yes.
Remember that chart?
Yes, that's right.
The critical levels and the levels below the surface of the earth are the master.
Yes.
We had to go in consciousness.
Yes. Yes, I think this is a very valid point. There is a very abstruse, certainly, profound, certainly, deeply occult document which has received relatively little attention in our studies in the theosophical world. It was a document to which Fritz Kunz gave a great deal of attention and a great deal of a study, and on which he based a diagram. It appears as the appendix in the volume of letters of H.P. Blavatsky to A.P. Sinnott, and it is called Cosmological Notes. It came from one of the masters, and reference is made to it in, I think it's what we call letter 10 of the Mahatma letters to A.P. Sinnott, in which those were note, it was not actually a letter, you know, and that's why I say so-called letter 10, because it was not a letter, but was notes to accompany cosmological notes. But the full cosmological notes, are published as an appendix, in a very interesting sort of way that got buried there in that appendix to the letters of HPB to AP Synod. And it is a very abstruse document. It's an extremely interesting one. It takes an awful lot of real probing and real study. And on the basis of that, Fritz Kunz developed a diagram, which I don't have with me, but I think a very interesting diagram, and proposed, and indeed we know this is true. Annie Besant and C.W.L. both refer to it. So later writers have referred to it. Certainly it's referred to in the Secret Doctrine, that there are, even now, levels below what we call the physical. And it has been proposed, and Fritz was one who certainly proposed it and was completely convinced, I think, that the famous retreat on which the Master K.H. went during a period of the correspondence with A.P. Synod, that this was for the sake of a further initiation, not in this numerical order, but a further initiation, a further understanding of having to go into these far denser, indeed, with therefore pictured, whether symbolically or literally, I think one has to be careful of that, but one can say at least symbolically, I think it's far more symbolically, yes, within the earth. That is, within the density of the globe, into a further degree, and come back in full consciousness. And it seems quite legitimate, because the warning was given by the Master Morya not to disturb the body of my brother. Could not be disturbed at all. And it's, of course, very beautiful. If you're familiar with the Mahatma letters, I think it's one of the most beautiful descriptions, where now lies the lifeless body of my brother in this tower, Bodhisattva tower, where generations of Bodhisattvas have been nourished, something like that, nurtured. Can't quote it exactly, but it's I think, one of the most beautiful descriptions. And the fact that the body could not be disturbed would indicate that the consciousness had so far retreated from it as to penetrate deeper and deeper levels. It's a profound... Anyway, it's a suggestion. There is, and I always felt Fritz must have had good and legitimate reasons for his conviction on this matter.
Unfortunately, remember which volume, but in the collected writings there is a letter of HPB's, or maybe an article, in which she states very definitely that there is matter so heavy.
Yes, that's right.
Invisible.
That it's invisible to us. Yes,
so
yes. I can't remember either. I recall that article. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Very interesting. So perhaps that's the density that we, well, you know, but that we have to move through it in terms of consciousness. Other questions? It's a fascinating study. Well, let's continue then a bit, if we can. As we've pointed out then, the process then is that the structures of the vehicles, the structures of the globe itself, is, as it were, an integration of its own past experiences. But just as there is always a brooding intelligence, or whatever you want to call that inner principle, which we generally call the monad, which can furnish us with a way out of this endless cycle, so there was for the Earth, for Globe D, a guiding intelligence, a planetary regent, as it's often called, which would ultimately assist in bringing forth in this round, the fourth round, a properly constituted humanity. Now, as I say, we've already mentioned that the earth was aware in some way of this, in some dim manner, when she called on the Lord of the Shining Face to send those who would people her. But not only were the rather gruesome remains of early rounds in the forms that she did create of watermen and so on, not only were they the survivors of the process of cosmic and planetary chain pralayas, withdrawals, but there are other survivors. And this is, I think, we have to recognize. Not only did she, in other words, the earth, reconstitute the remains of the first three rounds out of, you see, reconstitute them, where they were survivors, but there are other survivors, what Shloka 1 of this series calls the dragons of wisdom, the perfected men of yesterday. In the shlokas of Volume 1, they're called Dhamma. And when the new round begins, they too awaken and turn outwards from their long vigil on the borders of absolute being. So they too are awakened. And so Shloka 6 continues the story. The Dhyanis came and looked. The Dhyanis from the bright father-mother, from the white regions, solar-lunar regions, they came from the abodes of the immortal mortals. So they too have been awakened, you see. And they came and looked. Barborka, of course, points out that the implication is very clearly that there were superior beings, not stationed on Earth, but on the earlier globes of the Earth chain, A, B, and C, as we call them. And here HPB introduces us to a specific class of superior beings whom we really haven't met before. You know, it's rather interesting. You keep meeting new groups of beings, you see. There are the Dhyanis. They are Lord, the very word Dhyani, indicating that they are meditative beings. Because the word Dhyani comes from Dhyan, to meditate. Dhyan, the same thing as we have the stanzas of Dhyan. Great meditative beings who have reached this stage through previous evolutionary cycles. But she calls them, rather interesting, by the name Vibhus, which comes from the Sanskrit word prab, which means skillful, inventive, clever. Rather interesting. The name, they're said to be semi-divine beings. And in exoteric literature, they're threefold. It's rather interesting always, you see. They're threefold, and they have three different names, therefore. You know, it's sort of like Fohat and Fohat Jr. The first one is Ribhu. So he's the son of Ribhu. The next is Vaya. And let's see, who's the third one? Oh, yes. Vibhavan. Vibhavan, rather. Now, HPB adds that the three Ribhus, who yet become thrice seven in number of their gifts, so there are 21 of them, you see, but they become, there are three of them who become thrice seven. And, of course, this is easily explained, as Barborka does it too, that as there are seven watchers for the seven groups of monads, one watcher for each one of the seven groups, the thrice seven again refer to the three groups of seven on the three superior globes. So these are, in a sense, they're a bit lower than the highest Dhyanis, but they're above us, so to speak. You see. I mean, someday you may become a ribhu, if you're clever and inventive enough, Diana, you see. Rather interesting. Now, the reference that these beings come from the abodes of the immortal mortals indicates that they do come from globes A, B, and C, and represent the sishtas, or seeds, of a future humanity. So, the immortal mortals. What they see, of course, is not really to their liking, you know. They really don't like what they see. As Ashish puts it, all that is to be seen in the waters of existence are the dregs of previous worlds, corpses, as it were, stirring with the tides of awakening desire. But they are really the ones, of course, who must eventually give assistance for the new round, the fourth, to fulfill its part in the cosmic drama. Their help is needed. You can't get along without them. And so, as again to quote Ashish, essentially at one with the cosmic harmony, they make manifest that compassion which is the unity of life and the divinity of love, while as separate beings they guide the evolving race of men towards their own perfection. Well, the scene is perhaps rather pathetic, and again it's rather graphic in the shlokas. I think it's, again, just as pathetic as earth laboring and bringing forth water men and goat men and so on. Perhaps it's something like being sent off to the worst slums of Calcutta. The only way I can visualize it. You know, there, here you are, you know, you've just got on your nice, you know, white garb and everything clean and so on, and you're told to go into the slums of Calcutta. Displeased they were. Our flesh is not there, they said. This is no fit rupa for our brothers of the fifth. No dwellings for the lives. Pure waters, not turbid, they must drink. Let us dry them. So at least they're willing to do something, you know, let's dry them. Let's, you know, sort of get this muddy water off of them, this incrustation of the desires of the past. Let's sort of, you know, get them cleaned up a little bit, and then maybe we can do something with them, these forms. Well, HPB then proceeds with a very lengthy passage which, from what she calls the Catechism, and she designates it parenthetically commentaries, and this, of course, is the occult work to which she had access. It's not at all an easy passage, but it's a fascinating passage. And I think it has to be considered before we really go into Shloka 7. So I'm going to read it, even though it's not an easy one. It is from the material worlds that descend they who fashion physical man at the new Manvantaras. They are inferior laws, that's LHA, spirits, you see, possessed of a dual body, an astral within an ethereal form. They are the fashioners of our body of illusion. Now, it is from the material worlds, don't get confused here, that we're talking about matter in this dense physical form. Remember that every world within a manifested system is matter of some kind or other. That isn't easy to recognize, perhaps, but it is. Into the forms projected by the laws, the petries, the two letters, the monad, and it's interesting she calls it the two letters, you see, because the monad is indeed a duality, And she says, called also the double dragon. The monad is Atma Buddhi. Into the forms projected by the Lahas, the Petris in this case, the fathers, the two letters, or the monad, descend from the spheres of expectation. Isn't that a marvelous phrase? The spheres of expectation. So it's not only, in a sense, from the past, but already perceiving what is expected. But they are like a roof with no walls nor pillars to rest upon. Man needs four flames and three fires to become one on earth, and he requires the essence of the 49 fires to be perfect. And of course, these four flames and three fires refer to the septenate that is the complete man. It is those who have deserted the superior spheres, the gods of will, who complete the Manu of illusion. For the double dragon has no hold upon the mere form. That is, that the monad, the double dragon, the monad has no hold upon the mere form. There is no connection yet. There's no connective tissue. You sort of have the monad there and this form wobbling about here. It is like the breeze where there is no tree or branch to receive and harbor it. Marvelously graphic, you see. It cannot affect the form where there is no agent of transmission. And then she has Manas, mind, and the form knows it not. So the agent of transmission, which has ultimately to be awakened, and of course it's not awakened for a long time yet, it's not awakened until the middle of the third developmental stage, the third root race, you see, when the incarnation of the Manasaputras, but Manas is present, but as a principle, but not yet as an agent of transmission, which serves as the connecting link between the dragon of wisdom, the monad, Atma Buddhi, and the four flames, or the lower quaternary. In the highest worlds, the three are one, Atma Buddhi Manas. On earth, at first, the one becomes two. At first, the one becomes two. So that this now the differentiation enters through Manas. They are like the two sides of a triangle that has lost its bottom line, which is the third fire. And the third fire is Manas, you see. So you have then, in a sense, you have a peculiar figure. You have this, you see, as the dragon of wisdom, the two, and down below you have this kind of semblance of a form, and nothing, you see, no link, until this is brought down and becomes this. It originally appears to be divided, and then becomes that. And of course, ultimately, to be indeed a master mason, this must come into the form, into the, must be expressed through that fully. Which was why the master mason's apron appears that way. Well, there, it's a marvelous passage. And there are a great number of footnotes explaining various terms in the passage. But I think we need to examine a little more closely Shloka 7, to which this is indeed the commentary. The first thing we notice about this particular group of dhyanis, the ribhus, who came and looked at the situation at the opening of the fourth round, is that, to use the words of the shloka, they say, our flesh is not there. That is, not in the forms which earth has produced. Now, quite obviously, the word flesh does not refer to physical matter as we know it. And of course, it is not even the very subtle matter which characterized the earth at this opening stage of the round. The clue to what is meant is given to us, I think, in volume 1, page 224, where HBB speaks of spiritual plasm in connection with the Dhyani, and suggests that what characterizes the Dhyani, this high stage, this level of consciousness, is the possession of spiritual plasm. And she defines that as the fluid that contains the five lower principles of the six-principled Dhyani. The fluid which contains the five lower principles of the six-principled Dhyani. Now, it still may not be terribly clear to you. Not clear, Diana? No. All right, well, let's look at it. Now, the Dhyani are called six-principled because they do not have a physical vesture. That's quite clear. So they're only six-principled. But HBB tells us further that they do that. That the five principles, buddhi, manas, kama, prana, and linga sharira, along with the seventh, atma, which is not really a principle, individualized principle, are linked together by means of this spiritual plasm. In other words, they are five principled. You see, this fluid, which for us, as I understand it, which for us is the auric egg, by analogy, which she gives as that which contains the six principles for us. For the Dhyani contains five principles with the sixth outside. For us, six with the seventh outside, are linked together by this spiritual plasm. This plasm, which is also termed then the Dhyani Chohanic fluid, you see, provides a prototypal pattern which is requisite for the development of human qualities and characteristics during the present fourth round stage of evolutionary development. And this could not be provided by nature's unaided efforts. So these are those who bring that fluid, that energy, if you like, that principle which is a container, and which therefore enables these forms to have a kind of cementing. Maybe it's like a lot of glue, bringing them together, sort of thing. Rather gruesome thought, perhaps, but I mean, most of us are sort of glued together, and sometimes we come unstuck, and, you know, I mean, we even say that we come unglued at times, so maybe it's not so bad. Well, the next point to note, then, you see, there, our flesh is not there. That is, what to the... to the Ribhu was flesh, not to us, but our flesh is not there. That is, our containing principle, our, which is to them flesh, because it's the outermost. Why is this flesh to us? Because it's the outermost, you see. So to the Ribhu, the Dhyani, that was the outermost. That was what they had. That was the medium through which their interior principles could be expressed. Do you see? So our flesh wasn't there. No, of course not. Because these creatures were the product of Earth's own efforts. Now the next point to note And this is a very ticklish point. I'm not sure I want to take it up today because we don't really have time. But a statement which these dhyanis make, these are not fit rupas for our brothers of the fifth. Now, of course, first of all, we can take up the fact that the use of the term brother indicates a very close connection between this particular group of ribhus, this particular group of dhyanis, and nascent humanity, our humanity. You see, it's a very, our brothers, you see. So it must mean that they are, as it were, in terms of consciousness. You may say, well, aren't the masters the next above us? The masters are part of our humanity. Do you see? These are part of a previous humanity, which in its totality has gone just one step ahead, so they can still look at us as brothers, or we can look at them as brothers. They have already achieved a certain state on A, B, and C, says HPB. You see. Now, not as high a stage as the Agnishvata Petris. You see, there are levels all the way along. Levels all the way along. So it's a relationship that HPB refers to, incidentally, on page 133 of volume 1. You see how you have to go back and forth here. But there she says, to the highest, we are taught, belong the seven orders of the purely divine spirits. To the six lower ones belong hierarchies that can occasionally be seen and heard by men, and who do communicate with their progeny of the earth, which progeny is indissolubly linked with them. Each principle in man having its direct source in the nature of those great beings who furnish us with the respective invisible elements in us. It's marvelous. You see, we're indissolubly linked with this group, you see, who furnish us them, as it were, she says, each principle in man having its direct source in the nature of those great beings who furnish us with the respective invisible elements in us. Well, that's why, you see, these clever, inventive beings, I mean, some of us become rather clever and inventive, too. So, you know, that maybe is the characteristic they passed on to us, is a certain cleverness, as it were.
I wonder if we have the wrong idea from Plato about form, but it's form of man, and what you just said in this last 15 minutes. I'm sort of getting the idea that humanity means man is being created by this other level.
Mm-hmm.
We're not yet a form.
No, we're not yet a form at this stage. A form as we know it. I think one has to be careful in the use of Plato's concept of form, or the Aristotelian form even. Of course, the Aristotelian's very different, but what Plato implied by form, I think, is coming closer to a recognition that all energy of whatever nature, all energy assumes certain form, if you like, but not necessarily physical form of, you know, a head, two arms, two legs, etc.
Well, form would imply the sense perceptible.
Well, it depends.
We're talking about a level beyond that.
That's right. Oh, yes. But it's perceptible not by our five physical senses,
right,
however. But there are senses at other levels.
Yeah.
In other words, there's sentiency at all levels.
the six bodies.
Yes. Yes.
They never get down to our.
They do not enter. Body. You see, it is only in our humanity that we enter into the stula sharira. This is our particular function, man builder of forms, as Wallace Slater suggested in a booklet by that title, that we then are the one hierarchy that links the highest with stula sharira and building up the gross matter then into a greater malleability, permeability, usability, and so on.
You can see this happening invention of synthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And is that what that means by the work of humanity is to spiritualize matter?
Matter, yes. I think so. Yes. You see. So that this hierarchy, these Dhyani who came and looked, were ones just one step ahead, so to speak. They're still our brothers. Well, they're through the whole system, they're brothers, as it were, but these are, you know, closer to us in age. And they have not, but they do not have the physical principle to give. Earth has that to give. And of course, that's why when we come finally to that, really, I think, the most magnificent of the shlokas, shloka 17, in this, you see, which is jumping ahead. You know, here we are on shloka 7, but shloka 17, you see, this marvelous indication, the breath, that is now the human monad. You have to get used to the various names given to the monad. The breath needed a form. The fathers gave it. The breath needed a gross body. Now the form in this case is the chaya, the shadow. The fathers here are the lunar petris, the barhishads. The fathers gave it. The breath needed a gross body. The earth molded it. I mean, by this time she's getting pretty good at molding a body. She's turned out all these other productions. Now she's come along. The breath needed the spirit of life. The solar laws breathed it into its form. The breath needed a mirror of its body. We gave it our own, said the Dhyanis. The breath needed a vehicle of desire. It has it, said the drainer of waters. We'll come to what that means. But breath needs a mind to embrace